Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, on our last program, I began to discuss Lawrence's ability to move away from politics and continue his fight to procure Syria for the Arabs. So, for today's program, I want to get right back into that discussion. Now, I think it is important that I just review a little bit from the last program. And as we were concluding the program, remember we were talking about Lawrence's genius as a military, well, not only as a military leader, but as a military planner. And he wanted to start attacking the Turkish rail line as it went north to the geographic area called Syria. And again, remember, that is not like the Syria of today. It was like a, geographical concept, and it was partly in Lawrence's mind of what he wanted to get for the Arabic peoples. And so what we see today is the development of what finally took place after World War One. But he was really a gutsy guy. The station that Mudawar is what he wanted to take first, because he wanted to destroy the ability of the Turks to to get water, and they if he could take out that station, that water station, they would have to add a lot of train cars full of water to supply all their troops. And so it was really a great strategy. It was actually a superb strategy, but he had to fight terrible weather conditions to get there. It was 123 degrees in the shade, and then his guide was made blind by the burning sun. Then he had to deal with the rebellion against Otta because of Otta's lust for money and not sharing it any with the other, Arabic peoples. And so essentially, he headed to the water station with only 120 Arabs, including two British soldiers. And to his great disappointment, he realized that the Turks would overwhelm them, and that it would be really impossible for him to take, the water tank. And the thing is, he was so good at strategy, and he was so good, at protecting, his soldiers, that he wouldn't go ahead and just say, well, yeah, we'll go ahead and we'll try and take it. He just wouldn't do that. And he had the instincts of a born soldier. I just want to read to you this quote from page 315. And one thing about Lawrence is you can tell his moral background that he did get from, studying the Bible. His mother really taught him the Bible. And in some ways, I'm a little bit confused about his view of, kind of wanting to get that area of Syria for the Arabs and maybe not wanting it for the Jews as well, not wanting it for the Jews to move into that homeland. Because if he understood the Bible so well, I mean, he would have known that the Jews, were given that land by Almighty God. And so there's just some little dichotomies there, but Lawrence was a free thinker, and he would not be opposed to thinking differently than God. But here's what Korda says about Lawrence. And again, let's talk about his strengths. I mean, let's talk about his military strengths. And again, a lot of young people, just don't have the same kind of ambition or the same kind of fight today that he did. And in some ways, certainly America, Britain, even little Judah, there is really a change in young people's thinking, and they're more selfish. But here's what what Corda says about Lawrence in terms of his instincts as a soldier. He says, Lawrence might as well have attended Sandhurst as an officer cadet. Now, we know that Winston Churchill attended Sandhurst, and of course, all of the listeners to KPCG.FM have known Mr. Stephen Fleury's talked about Winston Churchill on the radio. We've talked about Winston Churchill on JBL, and he was trained at Sandhurst, and really, in many ways, Lawrence and Churchill, were the same way. But they really weren't warmongers, and I think I'm going to be able to show you that by the end of this program today. And, a lot of people criticized, Winston Churchill for loving war, and he did not love war. I mean, he did not. He knew if there was a fight that had to be won, he was going to win it. But he wasn't just out lusting to get into a fight just to kill somebody. But anyway, Lawrence may as well have attended Sandhurst as an officer cadet. From the very first, he displayed the instincts of a born soldier. However wild and undisciplined the Arabs might be, Lawrence was as careful as any professional in choosing the right ground, selecting a field of fire, working on his logistics down to the last bullet and pint of water, and preparing an avenue of retreat in case it proved necessary. Guerrilla warfare, it might be, with all the messiness that such warfare entails, but he waged it with the care and instincts of an exceptionally capable regular officer. He left nothing to chance. And so that's something we really need to, we can apply that even in our own lives and leave nothing to chance. And so many people today will leave their finances to chance, leave, child rearing or raising their children, they leave it to chance. Some people leave the development of love in their marriages to chance. And so, we can't do that. We have to be skilled, having a plan and a strategy really for all areas of our life. So Lawrence decided to not attack the water station. And the reason is he could not have won it. And also, he was going to put the men that was under his control, the Arabic people that were under his control, but also the two soldiers, he was going to put them in grave danger. And, he did not just expend people's lives, willy-nilly. He just didn't do that. He did love life. He wanted to preserve their lives. And, he left nothing to chance. But then, essentially what he did then is he decided, well, if I can't take the station, then he was going to start working the railways right away. He was going to start blowing them up. And remember, he wanted to head north. And again, that was to that geographical imaginary place that he called Syria. And other people at that time called it Syria as well. But it was not as yet a country. Now, essentially, remember now, Lawrence wanted to grab that country with the Arab leaders to keep it from the French and even in some ways from the British. And so Lawrence did have, he had his own plan. And again, I think that was, maybe where he was wrong in all of this. And again, we've talked in previous programs about human nature. We all have our human nature. We all want to do things our way. And Lawrence is no exception. And, he may have been great in his genius on certain areas, but, we really have to learn that sometimes we can't rely just on our own thoughts and our own feelings. Now, the thing is, one thing about Lawrence is, again, he was a guerrilla fighter. He did really help develop that. And, other terrorists have studied him and have actually mimicked what he did. And, Chairman Mao did it. The Vietnamese did it to America into the Vietnam War. And, the terrorists today are doing the same thing, to America in the Middle East. They have their IEDs, they have their bombs that are underground that people can't see them. it wasn't too long ago, just this month, we had the memorial of 9/11, and here they made the terrorists made whole airplanes bombs. You know, and look at the devastation. Over 3,000 people in America were killed. So anyway, but on this railway is where Lawrence began to teach the Arabs how to use explosives. And I just want to read you some of this from the book he wrote. And this is page 316. And I'm probably going to read a little bit more to you today. And again, I think some have expressed that they do like it when we read on the program, and sometimes it's good to be read to. But this is Salem, the most senior of Faisal's slaves, was given the honor of wielding the exploder, and Lawrence spent the afternoon teaching him how. It required a firm but not over hasty push to produce the right spark. As the sun began to set, they returned to where the camels should have been, only to find that the Arabs had moved up to a high ridge where they were clearly outlined against the setting sun, attracting the attention of the Turkish outposts and drawing a certain amount of nervous rifle fire. Lawrence seldom complained about the Bedouin. It was in their interest and to his to portray them as natural fighting men with a born talent for desert warfare. But later, in Seven Pillars of Wisdom, he noted with disapproval how their contempt for the Turks made them incautious. And unlike British soldiers, they were restless and noisy while waiting, without the patience to stay put and remain quiet. So again, Korda gives us deep insight. Here he's trying to teach them something very dangerous, and he's trying to get them to stay put and hidden, and you know, they're not going to listen to them. They're going to do what they want. And so what they didn't understand is they were drawing the attention of, a much stronger army than they were. And, Lawrence could see it right away. Now, I just want to continue his decision to attack the trains. He was trying to get them ready for it. It says, in the morning, as Lawrence had feared, a Turkish patrol marched out of the station in search of them. Lawrence ordered 30 of the Arabs to open fire and then lead the Turks as slowly as possible away from the railway tracks where they might discover the mine and into the surrounding sand hills. At noon, a stronger patrol appeared, and Lawrence was just about to order his party to pack up and retreat, leaving the mine behind in the hope of returning another day and setting it off under a train, when he saw the smoke of a locomotive in the distance. In an instant, he placed his Arabs behind a long ridge running parallel to the track, from which they could fire at the train at a distance of about 150 yards once it was derailed. He left one man standing up to watch the train's progress in case it was full of troops and should suddenly stop to let them off for a rush attack. But to his relief, the train did nothing of the sort. Drawn by two locomotives, a welcome bonus for Lawrence, the train kept on coming. Turkish soldiers struck the muzzles of their rifles out of the open windows or sheltered on the roof of each carriage behind sandbags, prepared to fend off an Arab attack. But they clearly did not anticipate the full magnitude of what was to come. And so here's the boldness of Lawrence. And once he decided, what to do, again, he was quick. He was, he saw the trouble of the Turkish guards coming or the Turkish troops coming. But then he stayed observant enough to see that it was actually would play into his hands if he was just patient enough and if the Arabs listened to him. And so that's what you call, a great soldier. And, that's where he had the patience that he needed. Now, again, I think this is great reading. Pages 316, 317. It's just stirring, of course, I think if you get the chance to see Lawrence of Arabia with Peter O'Toole, I think some of the scenes in the movie, they do a great job of showing, I think, even this very, exact event. So I just want to continue here on page 317 now. It says, as the second locomotive began to cross the bridge, Lawrence raised his hand and Satan, the slave, pushed the exploder. With a mighty roar, the entire train vanished in a huge explosion of black dust. 100 feet high and equally wide, out of the darkness came a series of shattering crashes and a long, loud, metallic clanging of ripped steel, while many lumps of iron and plate with one wheel of a locomotive whirled up suddenly black out of the cloud against the sky and sailed musically over our heads to fall slowly in the desert behind. Now, Korda is quoting from Seven Pillars of Wisdom by Lawrence. So that's what he wrote himself. Now, Korda continues, for a few moments there was absolute silence as a cloud of smoke drifted away. Then the Arabs opened fire on the shattered carriages, while Lawrence, dodging under their bullets, ran back to join the two sergeants on their ledge. By the time Lawrence got to them, the Arabs were leaving their positions to rush for the train and loot it, while those Turks who had survived the explosion fired back desperately. He found Lewis and Stokes, those are the two British soldiers, calmly going about their works, Lewis sweeping the Turks off roofs of the carriages with his machine gun, and Stokes firing his mortar bombs over the carriages to the far side, where the Turks huddled on the embankment. Stokes' second shot made a shambles of the group, and the survivors broke eastward as they ran. The sergeant grimly traversed with drum after drum into their ranks till the open sand was littered with dead bodies, while the Bedouin were beginning, like wild beasts, to tear open the carriages and fall to plunder. It had taken nearly 10 minutes. So you can imagine the devastation that was created in 10 minutes. And can you imagine Lawrence? This was another success, against the Turks. And but we're going to see here in just a few minutes that it was war really had its impact on Lawrence's whole being and his mind and his thoughts about himself. Now here's what Korda goes on to say. It says Lawrence had destroyed the bridge completely. All the carriages were smashed, including one that contained sick and wounded Turks, some of them dying of typhus. Lawrence found that the Turks had rolled dead and dying into a bleeding heap at the splintered end of the carriage. One locomotive was smashed beyond repair. The other was less seriously damaged. But Lawrence calmly finished this one off by attaching explosive to its boiler and detonating it. The train had been full of troops, civilian refugees, and the families of Turkish officers. Now the thing is, we could get excited that this was a win, but there is a human side to it that was devastating. And eventually, Lawrence would write about it. And here's another quote from Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And this is how Lawrence described the scene. He says, raving mad, the Bedouin were rushing about at top speed, bareheaded and half-naked, screaming, shooting in the air, clawing one another nail and fist, as if they looted the living and the dead. The wives and the children of the Turkish officers gathered around Lawrence, begging for mercy, and were then pushed out of the way by their husbands, who tried to seize and kiss Lawrence's feet. He kicked them away in disgust, and went on to accept the surrender of a group of Austro-Hungarian officers and NCOs, artillery instructors, one of whom was seriously wounded. Lawrence, who had seen a large Turkish patrol leaving the station, promised that the Turks would be there with help in an hour, but the man died of his wounds, and Lawrence went on to deal with other problems, including a dignified and infirm old Arab woman whose servant he managed to find. The old woman would later send him a valuable carpet from Damascus as a token of her gratitude. In the meantime, the Bedouin killed all but two or three of Lawrence's Austrian prisoners. Now, again, that's not as an exciting scene when you see the effect of war and how it, what it has on maybe some innocent people. And just part of this scene and part of what happened this day, it really affected Lawrence you know, for the rest of his life. I don't want to just read you some more accounts of how this impacted Lawrence, and just to you know, make it clear, like Winston Churchill, he was not a warmonger. He was he did not just favor war, but he favored winning, and he did have a desire. You know, he did love the Arabs. He did want them to have, you know, what they treasured most. But this is the top of page 319. And again, what Court is doing is he's making some pretty strong quotes from the Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Let me just read this to you. It says, the account of the raid on the train at Mudawara in Seven Pillars of Wisdom is a literary set piece, one of the great pieces of modern writing about war. Dry, businesslike, and ever so slightly ironic in tone, it's brilliantly underplayed, so that at first the only moments of horror the reader feels are when Lawrence enters the smashed carriages of dead or dying Turks, when he is surrounded by women pleading for their lives, or when the Austrians are killed after surrendering to him. But reading his account of the incident a second time, one realizes just how gifted a writer Lawrence was. The horror is there, all right, in tiny details, just as it is in the battle scenes in Tolstoy's War and Peace, or in the certain scenes in Hemingway's A Farewell to Arms. The spare, unemotional prose, unlike Lawrence's much lusher descriptions of landscapes and people, does not hide the reality of the incident. The dead and the dying Turks, the shooting of the Arab wounded, the noise, smoke, bloodshed, fear, carnage, and wild looting, all of it over and done with in less than 10 minutes, in that implacable desert heat. The scene is a small masterpiece like a sketch by Goya. Lawrence does not tell us what he felt and does not for a moment try to present himself as heroic or sympathetic, nor does he attempt to infuse the scene with glory or shock the reader with blood and gore of battle. Painstakingly, he simply attempts to tell the reader exactly what happened. And you know, Lawrence was greatly impacted by not only his success, but the horror of his success. And, you know, he wrote about this to different people. Corda goes on to say, shortly after Lawrence wrote to Frank Sterling, a fellow intelligence officer in Cairo, who would himself go on to become one of the British Army's boldest adventurers and guerrilla leaders, and to carve out his own fame in both world wars and in between them as Colonel W.F. Sterling, and also to write a lively account of his life in a memoir aptly entitled Safety Last. Lawrence wrote to him. So this is what Lawrence wrote to him after this incident. He says, I hope this sounds the fun it is. It is the most amateurishly Buffalo Billy sort of performance. But that was intended to appeal to Sterling, a man straight out of AEW's Mason's The Four Feathers, who was never happier than when bullets were whizzing past his head, or who would oddly enough become an advisor on the first attempt to make a film of Lawrence's desert campaign and live on to survive being shot 6 times by a Palestinian terrorist. So the point is that Korda is beginning to say is that Lawrence would talk about this differently with different people, and in some ways he may have been just trying to appeal to the other person. And so there has been a little bit of confusion over how did Lawrence really relate to this. And here's what Korda says some more about what he wrote. It says, Lawrence wrote about the attack on the train at Mudawara in a very different spirit to his old friend Leeds at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, with whom he had no need to posture as a hero from Boy's Own. I'm sure that's another story, English story. It says, and this is what Lawrence writes to his friend Leeds. I hope when this nightmare ends that I will wake up and become alive again. This killing and killing of Turks is horrible. When you charge in at the finish and find them all over the place in bits and still alive, many of them, and you know you have done hundreds in the same way before and must do hundreds more if you can. So Lawrence wrote him completely differently about how this battle at Mudawara, or just blowing up this train, really affected him. And here's what Korda goes on to say. Many of those who have written about Lawrence have felt the need to decide between these two very different ways of looking at warfare and come to some conclusion about which one represents the authentic Lawrence. The self-congratulatory but faintly self-mocking heroic mode, unshocked by bloodshed, or the bitterly self-critical mode with its deep sense of guilt about his own efficiency as a killer and his fear that he has crossed a moral line and can never recross it to return to normal life. Of course, allowance must be made for the fact that Lawrence, perhaps more than most people, altered the style of his letters to suit the recipient. Indeed, even his most casual letters are artfully written to please. Thus, the tone of his letters to Bernard Shaw is radically different from that of his letters to Charlotte Shaw, for example. So, Korda brings this out, and I think it is something that we want to think about, especially as we conclude our series on Lawrence. And it is something to be skilled at killing people, and essentially, Lawrence had studied all those battles all those years, and now he finds that he is the soldier in the middle of the battles. And I think he was greatly affected by it more than he let some people know. Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. Next time, we'll discuss what is important in Chapter 8. We are rapidly concluding our series of programs on T.E. Lawrence using Michael Korda's book, Hero, the Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. In the first week of November, we will begin a new series titled A Tribute to Charles Krauthammer. We will be reading selected portions of his book of essays titled Things That Matter. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcug.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.